So, okay, so I'm supposed to give a tutorial on voltage-gated ion channels, and I don't actually know, presumably some of you who aren't volunteering to give this know more about this than I do, so I'm kind of embarrassed myself. But the intent of this is to basically, to remind you, or to tell you, probably more to remind you about the biology of channels and membranes and voltage-gated channels in particular. There are, of course, more than just voltage-gated channels. There are ligand-gated channels. There are mechanically gated channels. There are lots of different types of channels. But for the purposes of this discussion, we're going to talk about voltage-gated channels. And I believe that the talks next week will mainly focus on that as well. Whether there's a relationship between the different types of gating mechanisms is very interesting, and if we could get far enough to have an intelligible conversation about that, we will have succeeded. That seems quite difficult, and so therefore let's just stick to voltage-gated channels, which nothing else I hopefully will convince you today is hard enough. So this is sort of an outline. I was sort of sketching an outline to myself of what I was supposed to tell you, and then there are slides that are supposed to back up to different bits, and it's disorganized. So what I'm going to do is I'm first going to just remind you of the history, just a little bit of the history of this, of where the idea came from and why it's important. I'm then going to remind you or tell you, that, you know, that there's a potential difference across cell membranes that is driven by concentration differences in ions, and that there's sort of a fundamental equation called the Nernst equation, which relates the concentration differences on the two sides of the membrane with the voltage drop across it. That voltage drop, of course, is used for enormous numbers of things in biology. An interesting question is, what's the minimal system that you can build to generate a said voltage drop? I don't actually think that is known, but what do I know? At least I don't know it. That doesn't mean that it's not known, of course. The most relevant ions are sodium, potassium, chlorine, and calcium, and there are different types of channels for each ion type. I'll sort of talk about that a bit. The channels actually have the really remarkable feature that they're ion selective. That is that, for example, the potassium channel lets through, I think that the number is 10,000 times as much potassium as sodium, which is remarkable when you consider that potassium and sodium are in the same row of the periodic table. They're both basically spheres. I mean, they're in the first row. They don't have any structure. And the difference in the ionic radius is, I don't know, it's like 0.2 or 0.3 angstroms. It's some insanely small thing. And the amazing thing about the potassium is actually bigger than sodium. So potassium actually lets through 10,000 times as much potassium as sodium, even though the sodium is smaller. So you have to imagine, how am I going to design a sieve which lets big balls through and not little balls? And this problem was solved about 10 years ago by Rod MacKinnon, who then won the Nobel Prize for it. And I'll tell you a bit about that, just a little bit about that. There are chlorine channels, there are calcium channels. Then I'll talk about other things. So what I don't have very much of in this.
Tell us why you would use calcium versus sodium versus potassium.
You mean for various things? So I mean, at first approximation, I'm incompetent to tell you why you would do anything. I certainly that issue will come up. That is, what is the physiological use of these various ions, right? We'll talk about that a bit in this. I mean, that is, we can talk about it more. But if I don't talk about it enough, then let's talk about it and learn more about it. Because there are prokaryotic voltage-gated ion channels. There's certainly potassium channels. I think David Clapham, in fact, David Clapham, who is coming, discovered a prokaryotic voltage-gated sodium channel. And this was in the last decade, and it was a great surprise, as I understand it. And we can ask him about that. So it's calcium, I don't know. Well, because no one knew about them. Everybody just knew about the potassium channels. I mean, so he discovered it. It was a surprise. I don't know why you would have one versus the other. I have no idea. I mean, it seems clear. I mean, one of the things actually I sort of find fascinating about this is that it seems clear. I mean, for example, Another question, which I think is related to the question that you're asking, which is more complicated, I don't know if it's more complicated or simpler, I have no idea, is what is it that sets the ion concentrations anyway across the membrane? I mean, these are like given by God as far as the textbooks are concerned. Like God said that, you know, it was this concentration inside and that outside. And of course, there's variability. And presumably, that's environment dependent. I mean, I just don't even know how we're supposed to deconvolve this. And that may, so, we should certainly talk more about this. I can babble, but I don't really have very much to say, as I just demonstrated. Now for posterity. See, isn't this great? This thing about being taped, I don't know. So the other thing is, and this is, I'm not going to talk much about this, but we could learn more about this if people were interested, is that there are, of course, pumps. So there are specific channels which actually, so all of these things don't use ATP in translocating. These are passive. I mean, so there are also pumps whose job is to set up the concentration gradient across the membrane, and there are really two types of pumps that people talk about. Now, I should say this is sort of what textbooks say, and as is always the case, it's probably true that if one dug into it more, it's much more complicated than the sort of simple textbook picture. But the textbook picture is that there are calcium pumps and there are sodium potassium pumps, and so the calcium pumps pump calcium. There's essentially no calcium inside of cells. You'll see this. The typical concentration of calcium inside of a cell is basically zero. And outside, and so there's a huge concentration difference. Sodium, and this is a calcium pump which uses energy to set that up. Sodium potassium pump basically exchanges inside outside potassium for sodium. It's three sodiums are exchanged for two potassium requiring one ATP. So we can talk about that a little bit. What we'll get to, hopefully, is that there's a huge variability in these different types of channels. Every time we say there is a sodium channel, there's not just one sodium channel, there are huge numbers of sodium channels, which are different genes. When you say there's a potassium channel, huge numbers of different potassium channels. And the main physiological difference, to the best that people can tell, between these different channels this statement has been known for a long time, is that ion permeabilities in general are voltage dependent. This goes back to Hodgkin and Huxley, which I will tell you or remind you of in a minute. The sort of specific voltage depend, the specific ways in which the different channels are voltage dependent change from channel to channel, and we'll talk more about that. So anyway, that's an outline. But if there's things that you want to talk about that aren't here, then especially if you know something about them, then please talk about them. Okay. So history. So this is just you. We should always admire. Also, if you're preparing a talk, this is the secret. You know, this is my only thing. I know that if it's midnight and you have to give a talk the next morning and you don't have anything, you should start pasting abstracts from papers. Anyway, and this is a So this sort of is the brainchild. This field is the brainchild of Hodgkin and Huxley, who were really interested in nerve excitation. So this is the beginning of the last in a series of papers they wrote. This article concludes a series of papers concerned with the flow of electric current through the surface membrane of a giant nerve fiber. Its general object is to discuss the results of the preceding state papers, put them in mathematical form, and show they account for conduction and excitation in quantitative terms. So this is the reason I put this here. So one of the main uses of voltage-gated ion channels is that these are, of course, the molecular basis of nerve excitability in a nervous system. I just put a little bit more. So summary of the experimental results. So this is just the data as they collected it. Of course, it's become much more fancy now. There's much, much more. But just to sort of give you a flavor of where these things are coming from, the results in the preceding papers suggest that the electrical behavior of the membrane may be represented by a network, blah, blah. Current can be carried through membrane either by charging the membrane capacity or by moving ions through the resistances in parallel. The ionic current is divided into components, sodium and potassium, and the small leakage current. The leakage current actually is now known to consist of other channels, that essentially have non-voltage dependent permeability. So for example, although we're not going to talk about them today, although we could talk about them, although I don't know much about them, so I don't have much more than this to say, there are non-voltage dependent sodium and potassium channels. I believe they're even selective non-voltage dependent sodium and potassium channels. There are, of course, channels that, I mean, and these are, there's sort of many fewer of them on a membrane. And these, so sodium and potassium channels in and of themselves tend to be separated about a micron apart. I mean, if you just take a typical excitable membrane and look at it, that's what we're talking about. Each of the components is determined by a driving force, which is blah, 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 and the sodium current. Okay, and then he goes on. So, and he says the experiment suggests that the conductances are functions of time and potential, and then he goes on to try to think about them. And there's a thing in this which is really remarkable, actually. This is perhaps the most remarkable thing. I'm sure there are many remarkable things. This is the thing I find the most remarkable about this paper, is that they say that they didn't, of course, know about the channels at that time. In fact, I mean, they didn't know about anything. This was 1950. 52. Oh, could you?
No, from the previous.
Oh, I should say, okay, because you can give this talk. I'm looking for someone else. So this is 1952. But they say at present the thickness and composition of the excitable membrane are unknown. Our experiments are therefore unlikely to give any information about the nature of the molecular events underlying the changes in the permeability. But they knew, and they showed experimentally, that there had to be channels that were potassium and sodium selective. They knew this, and they appreciated that that this was a remarkable thing. That, you know, that how the hell could you ever do this? But then they used theory. This is also interesting, since this is the ITT. This is actually a valid use of theory. That the object of the section is to show that certain types of theory are excluded by our experiments, and that others are consistent with it. It's very modest, which is the way it should be. Okay. So this is sort of jumping to the present. This is now, I don't know if this is the present. I have no idea if this is the present or 10 years. I don't know when this is. But anyway, today is today. So jumping to today, figures you can steal from papers. So now a lot is known about these things, and these are sort of two representations of what is known, right? So this is a sort of cartoon representation of what the channels look like in a membrane. Actually, this is post-McKinnon, because you see something is known about the interior structure of the potassium channel. This is a potassium channel. In general, actually, I guess I should sort of say, sodium, potassium, calcium channels are each consist of four subunits. There are four domains. Potassium channels tend to be tetramers. That is, it tends to be that the protein, it consists of four bits which are glued together, four different proteins that are glued together, whereas the sodium channel, which is shown here, tends to be one long protein. So this is the sodium channel. You'll notice, and this sort of goes back, this picture is both to sort of show you that so to show you something about the proteins, and also to say that this is a field with an enormous intellectual history in terms of the biophysics of the response of these channels. So it's known that, for example, the sodium channel, this is a sodium channel, consists of four domains, each which has six transmembrane helices. In the sodium channel, one and three are much more similar than two and four. Thus, it is believed that there is, it's not unreasonable to imagine there was a gene duplication event that gave rise to this. The purpose of these channels is to open and close in a voltage-dependent fashion, and as I will tell you, there are sort of various things known that really go back to Hodgkin and Huxley about the way that these things open and close. There are essentially two different mechanisms, I guess I can tell you right now. One is that the hole can open and close, like you can constrict, you can open and close a hole. And the other thing is, and this isn't on this picture, because this isn't really understood as well. There's also what's called an inactivation gate, which you're supposed to think of pictorially as being a ball and chain that's hanging into the cytoplasm, and that it can also bind to the hole. So you can close the hole in two ways. You can either physically close the hole, or you can block the hole with this thing. And both are voltage-dependent events. That is, the probabilities of each of these things happening occurs in a voltage-dependent fashion. And this gives rise to really a sort of non-trivial, but yet sort of understood dynamics of how this thing works, and we'll talk about that later. And in fact, the sequence determinants of the different bits are all essentially known. And the reason is there's just been, you can imagine. I mean, the great thing about voltage-gated ion channels is that you can measure the voltage. I mean, you can measure these are biophysical measurements that can be made. I mean, even at the single ion channel level. And so there's been a tremendous amount of work correlating mutations in channels with changes in the response and thus trying to figure out what corresponds to what. So for example, there's this little arrow here. So there's a linker between the domain 3 and 4, and it is known that this is the part that's responsible. There's, you know, a couple of amino acids thing that's known that is really responsible for inactivation, and that if you knock it out, that you completely change the voltage-dependent response. And this is... And essentially because of its pharmacological importance, that is, for humans, there's just a huge amount of knowledge about this.
I had a naive question. So the channels are really tiny, right? They're angstroms.
Yeah.
They're at the core.
Yeah.
So does one know the characteristics of the surface inside? Is it hydrophobic, filling?
Yeah, so I'll talk a little bit about that. I could talk more. This is what wasn't known until McKinnon. Nothing was known until McKinnon. And now I'll show you, actually. I think I only have one McKinnon picture in this. But we can go find more. It's actually a fascinating story how this works. And in fact, I can say more if you want. I don't know what's relevant, actually. I mean, in fact, for our only evolutionary biology, I mean, I have no idea what the hell is relevant for actually thinking about this in an evolutionary term. So I just babble.
To connect to Jim Lake's talk yesterday, the evolution of the double membrane cell, do you need that kind of structure then, presumably?
Which kind of structure?
A two-layered cell membrane.
You need a single membrane which has a concentration difference across it. You don't need, there's nothing in this that requires a double, I don't see why you need a double layer. I mean, you need an inside concentration and an out. I mean, the nice thing about a double membrane, actually. Yeah, I mean, one thing which wouldn't be nice about a double membrane, I guess, is that that means you have control in principle of the concentration in two compartments. Whereas if you only have one membrane, then you only have control of concentration inside. That's it. You can't control the outside. So, but you know, as you will see, the only thing that actually matters for the working of these devices is the difference in the concentration or the ratio of concentration. So
you said that there were some examples in prokaryotes of this kind of thing. So what kind of prokaryotes are they? Were they double membrane or single membrane prokaryotes?
I don't know the answer to that. I don't know. I mean, so I'll tell you what I believe. So I believe that potassium channels are widespread in prokaryotes. Even voltage dependent. I mean, voltage dependent and non-voltage dependent variety. So even sodium channels, I don't know how widespread they are. I mean, we can ask Clapham. Clapham will. I mean, it's not clear that there's any relationship between those and these. And it should be said that, let me just make a couple of other remarks. So there are beautiful studies, I mean, what do you want to call them? Sequence gazing studies of, can I determine the evolution of these various things? And as I said, there's this sort of amazing thing in the sodium channel that domain 1 and 3 is really very similar, and 2 and 4 is really very similar, which, you know, whatever you want to say, I mean, that's pretty striking. So, okay. I mean, they're all pretty damn similar, by the way. It's not that they're all basically the same, but you know, these two are much more similar than these two. So, and this actually, it's also true that they're all pretty much, they have a lot of similarity between sodium, potassium, and calcium. All three actually have the same basic structure, the same basic story. I mean, there are differences. Like, for example, potassium channels tend to be heterodimers. So there are four identical things that are glued together, which can be modified, of course. So they don't have to be identical. But you know, whereas in sodium and calcium, it's more like this. But there is a common evolutionary story, and there's an interesting question actually, which I don't. And also it says here there's common functions. I mean, they're different. I mean, there are differences in the way that our body uses calcium and sodium. I mean, calcium is, you know, mainly used. I don't know. Maybe, for example, it's used for muscle contraction, right? It's very, very important for myosin, you know, these sorts of things. Whereas sodium, I think it's pretty much used for this. But anyway, but what I was going to say is that you could ask the question, though. So there are trees, and we should, I think, in the paper that I put out for tomorrow, you know, we can talk about the trees. But I mean, one thing which is sort of peculiar about this is, at least I find peculiar about this, is that, I mean, you could ask, how many mutations does it take to change a sodium channel into a calcium channel? That's an interesting question. Because, you know, if you're a poor bug or whatever, if you're me, and, you know, please don't change my sodium channel into a calcium channel, that would be bad. I don't know what would happen. Well, actually, I do, in fact. It would not be good, right? So, and it turns out the answer is not many, like two or three. Very small numbers of mutations can modify, because we're talking essentially about modifying the selectivity filter, which is really gets back to the sort of the point that you brought up, is what is controlling, right, what gets through here, right? I mean, there's sort of two things. What's determining what gets through? It has to be selective, because otherwise the whole story of neural signaling goes away, basically. And it also has to be, and it also has to have particular voltage-dependent characteristics. I mean, there are diseases in which, there are human diseases on, they're called sodium channelopathies, right? You have point mutants in sodium channel, and basically, you know, that's it, right? I mean, they're lethal, epilepsy comes from single mutation, and then people have studied, you know, the kinetics of the channels to try to figure out what the hell is the difference, and the situation is they observe that there's a difference. But it's not big enough. I mean, if I showed you the difference, you would say, I think I have one of those slides in this talk. So, okay, so that's that. Okay, so this is my only thing on...
I guess this issue of the two-layered membrane, it is fundamental to trying to understand the evolution of the eukaryotic cell, because there's been this long debate about, you know, where the eukaryotic cell came from. I guess Jim didn't really talk very much about it, but one idea is that it was an archaeal bacteria, archaebacterium, that, and I think most people agree that the ancestor eukarya was some kind of weird hybrid. And so one idea was an archaeal bacteria that, say, engulfed the mitochondria had to have been engulfed, for example.
Yeah.
But if it was an archaeal bacteria, then I guess that's a single membrane cell.
Yeah.
So that would bring in the channels for the cell membrane. But then what about organelles? Do mitochondria have
channels?
Channels?
Yes. Everything's decorated with channels. Everything's decorated with channels. They're everywhere.
Everything.
Everywhere. I don't know that the nuclear membrane has ion channels in them. I mean, in fact, I think the nuclear membrane, see, this is the problem with people. That's okay. I don't mind being ignorant on recorded fashion. I think it doesn't, actually, because it's a double membrane, right? I mean, it has this fold-over thing. So I don't see how it would work. So I think it doesn't. I mean, the nuclear pore is the main hole that basically deals with the nucleus, I think. Yeah? You know, nobody disagrees. Nobody knows. Okay. Ignorance is bliss. Okay, but so, yeah, I mean, maybe.
The mitochondria there are stuff transported into the mitochondria, like tRNAs, for instance. So, how would they get through?
Yeah, almost everything is imported into the mitochondria.
Right, well, so they're going to be channels.
Proteins.
Right, so they're channels. Right. I don't know what they are, though, those. I mean, that's actually an interesting question. So there must be more general. I mean, there are more general. I mean, well, obviously. So, I mean, obviously, this is the thing. This is the one thing about this particular presentation is that it's really only about, I'm only talking at the moment about voltage-gated ion channels, which I think, you know, do have the advantage. I mean, the reason for this is that the, I mean, I think it's fair to say that the most is known about them. I mean, actually, the biophysics of this has just been going on for so long and at such a high quantitative level that really an enormous amount is known, and there are lots of sequences. So, but there must be more. I mean, do you know, I mean, they could be ATP dependent too. I mean, there is this thing that there's some transport requires energy. Right? Neither the nuclear pore nor the voltage-gated ion channels today that we're talking about require energy for transport. I don't know if that's important, actually. I have no idea. I mean, that is in thinking about it in evolutionary terms. I mean, I just have no idea.
I think the nuclear pore complex are channels that don't take any energy, actually.
Yeah, the nuclear pore complex doesn't take energy. There's no energy.
Doesn't take energy, and I don't think it is voltage controlled.
It's not voltage controlled. There's no energy. No.
That's
right.
Like, I don't know, geometrical or mechanical.
Yeah, that's right. We'll talk about that tomorrow. That's tomorrow. Tomorrow we will effort to talk about that. But that's... Okay, so...
Maybe I'll add one thing about this prokaryotic potassium channel. I mean, I don't know much, I mean, just adding more facts to this story, is potassium is one of the key ions for osmotic regulation in prokaryotes. So if you screw up them, they are basically gone. So it sort of they balance out their potassium and glycerol to match up their osmotic balance.
Right, but
whenever you trigger something.
Right, but an interesting question is why was potassium chosen as the ion, right?
I mean, some ecological reason. I mean, they lived in environments where they were. But I don't know, yeah. Something, some really tangent.
Yeah, I mean,
something which we
have
Yeah. Well, potassium phosphate, for example, is one of the sources of phosphorus. I don't know.
Yeah.
For example, that's what they put in their media and so on and so forth. And, partly it's not only for phosphate, but also for potassium. But,
Anyway, this is a sculpture that McKinnon, I found this on Wikipedia this morning, early in the morning. I'm trying to find a picture. And this is a sculpture that he commissioned of his structure. So this is his, this is the potassium channel. The sculpture apparently uses the molecular coordinates. And actually, up through the middle, there's this hole, which is where the ions go through. And maybe actually I should say something about this, because you asked, and it may be relevant, and I don't know. So I'm going to, I'll draw, I have to draw. So so basically, the problem, where, do the lights in this room? Are there lights in this room? Okay. Good. So the problem, so let me just sort of talk about the basic problem that ion channels have to solve. So if I can do this on the fly. So this is water. This is water, and this is lipid. And what you have to do is you have to get a charge across this thing. And so there were sort of two problems that McKinnon's structure, at least as I understand it, solved. So one is that there's this funny thing, this is a physical fact, which is that the self-energy, that is if you ask what is the energy of the charge, if I have a charge which has, charge is called E, that is in solution, let's suppose that charge has a radius A, then the energy E of the thing is basically E squared over epsilon A, where epsilon is the dielectric constant of the medium. And this epsilon basically in water epsilon is 80, so water has epsilon equals 80. And that basically sort of suppresses this, and that's because the water molecules are polar, and they basically turn around to basically to sort of lessen the effect of the field. Though on the other hand, lipid has dielectric constant 2, roughly. And so what you immediately see is that there is an energy difference. I mean, there's a huge energy barrier for pushing this thing across lipid. Because if you put it here, then the energy is E squared over epsilon A. If you stick it here, it's E squared over 80. So there's a factor of 40 difference in energy between these two things. And that 40, I haven't compared, I'm sorry, but that 40 is many kT. It's enough that basically you would say, screw it, it's not going across. And then you say, oh, well, not a problem, we're just going to make a little hole. So then it's going to be, okay, we'll fill the hole with water, everything's going to be fine. But then the problem is that if you do this calculation, well, it's got to be a small hole, right? Because remember, it's, at least at some point, it's going to be selective. I mean, you've got to get, because you have to basically, you have to siphon these things. So that if it's going to be a small hole, then if you take the thing and you stick it there, then you repeat this calculation, then it turns out the answer is the same. And it's not. I'm not. I mean, it's not exactly the same, but the moral point is the same, and that's because that basically, if you stick it there, then it's still true that most of the field is basically in the oil. It's not in the water. So I don't know. This is an exercise in electrostatics. So everybody was really very confused actually about how this could possibly work. And what McKinnon discovered, and what you see in this structure, there's sort of two notable features of this structure. One, and I have to turn off the blackboard light. Maybe actually. One is that you see that there's a hole and it goes through and there's this big glob. Okay, and this glob actually is in fact an aqueous hole. So what it looks like is this. So you have a big hole. So now if you make this big hole big enough, so it turns out that the law is, I think that this is basically right. So if the ion has size A, if the hole has size R, then the energy of putting the charge in the middle of this is basically epsilon E squared over epsilon R, instead where epsilon is the epsilon of lipid. So the point is you replace the ionic size with R, because basically basically what you've done is you've put water around it so the water is happy. So that basically, so if you make a big enough hole, right, then you can make it have the same energy as that, or at least make it sort of lower this energy balance and make things much better. And so one thing that McKinnon saw, which had been anticipated, I mean, people have thought about this, right, but was that there was this big hole. But that's not enough. If you go and you actually calculate, because what you'd really like, right, is, I mean, I think, actually, I don't know what you would like. You'd like the energy function to basically be flat for getting across this thing. You don't want to have to pay at all, because it's, you want the translocation to be entirely dictated by concentration differences and voltage differences. You don't want to actually have to pay because of the stupid energetics of ions. So if you go through the calculation, and McKinnon in his paper did that, but others have done it before, I think, then what you find is that the whole, that this is still not enough. Like if you just measure the radius, it's still not enough. And so what he discovered, which he was very excited about, and presumably justly so, and if you look at this, as you can see it barely, there are actually four helices. So there are big helices, and there are little helices in this. There are four helices which have dipole moments, and these are alpha helices with dipole moments, which are basically oriented so that the minus side is pointing inwards, and the plus side is pointing out, and it's all pointing to the center of the thing. And so the potassium channel, potassium is positive charge likes negative charge, so that, the claim is, lowers the energy enough to essentially flatten the landscape, at least up through the hole, up through here. So then the question is, what about the selectivity part? And so McKinnon knew that the selectivity part was here. Because of this sort of the history of mutagenesis and the ion channel business, right, people had gone through and like knocked, if you go back to this thing, right, if people had gone through, you know, and sort of changed amino acid by amino acid, said, I've lost selectivity, right? These experiments have been done to death. So they knew which amino acids were responsible for selectivity, and those amino acids were right here. And basically the story is, and I don't really understand more, the claim is the following thing. So how do you make it so that this lets through potassium and not sodium? That's the question. And the claim is that what it does is, imagine that you, and you want the energy barrier, remember, to be flat for potassium. So what you do is you basically somehow design the hole so that it just fits potassium, so it snugly goes through, and then you make the surface make the potassium feel like it's in water. Okay, so if you do that, so now of course, I mean, can you do that with proteins? Well, I don't know, so he claims you can. So that's, the claim is that you simply, you know, you have the OH things basically pointing in the right directions, the potassium feels like it's in water, and then when sodium goes through, it jiggles around, and that jiggling, I mean, basically, it's not, the energy is not, it doesn't feel like it's in water anymore, and that's a huge energy barrier, because these things are in exponentials, and so that takes care of it, and that's the claim. And in fact, it's even more, much more detailed than that. It's really a very interesting story, and which the evolution of which could I don't know what is interesting, which is that if you look at this, so this is the hole, and you'll notice how this is bumpy. There are four bumps. See that? So this is actually an accurate cartoon. The reason that there are four bumps is that McKinnon also discovered that there were, in fact, four binding sites for potassium ions in this thing. That there are actually four sites, and that there's this very complicated story, or very interesting story, in which the way that they actually go through, it's multi-ion conduction, that one goes in, and then it pops one of them into here, and then another one goes, and then the two are separated and separate in sites 1 and 3, and then basically another one goes and it pops the 2 and 4, and then it goes through. So that there's a multi-ion, there's a very complex, I think it's complex, multi-ion conduction mechanism, which underlies this. And this had been known, that is, it had been known that there was a multi-ion conduction mechanism, because you can measure that by simply measuring, right, current as a function of concentration difference and figure out if, you know, if it's linear or not. So this had been known for a long time, but this was the molecular realization of it. I don't think enough is known. I mean, well, enough is not known about mechanism to actually study, for example, the evolution of that. I mean, which, I don't know. So
Michael, where in that diagram is the aqueous chamber that you drew?
Here, I think, I believe this is the, yeah. The, and I must have stolen this from a paper that was interested in the voltage sensor. So there's, these things, remember, also open and close. Remember, there's that story too, right? They open and close. And it is known, if you look at the sequence, which part is voltage sensing. So see, voltage sensing points. But it is not known, and it is my understanding that it is a subject of rampant debate to this moment, in even in the potassium channels, of what the actual mechanism is for the voltage gating. That is, you know, there's got to be some lever arm that basically is moving in response to changes in voltage, and I do not, I think people are arguing about it. So in sodium channels, it is not known what the lever arm is. There are no structures in sodium. The structures that exist only exist in potassium. No one has been able to crystallize sodium. There are cryo-EM things of sodium that you know, the resolution is just too low to be able to see the structure. There are no structures in calcium, but there is homology, and they so there are trees. So, you know, that's the story.
Mike, can I ask another question?
Yes.
Of the Roman numerals you had that marked the components in that diagram, do those represent the fourfold?
Yes, that's fourfold.
Do you see in that artwork that is the...
Yeah, in this, yes, yes.
Well, I can't see them.
Yeah, you know, in this.
Yeah, that.
Yes. Yeah, yes. So sodium, potassium, and calcium all have four domains, and there's a fourfold symmetry. And in potassium, each of the four domains is a single protein. So there's one gene that codes for these four domains. In calcium and sodium, there is a single gene that codes for all four. And so this is a block diagram of the sodium channel, which this is a single gene. Well, actually, there's one gene that codes for all four. There are many, actually, I'll tell you this in a moment, there are many different voltage-gated sodium channels in every species, which have this general structure, which can be identified on the basis of sequence. Well, by a margin, blah, blah, blah.
So this diagram just for convenience, they're not really, you know, linear.
This is to show you that,
how do you go from that linear?
Is this in a circle? Am I supposed to think this is?
Yeah, it's in a circle. Yeah, yeah. This is just to visualize the thing. This is pulling it out. This is one way of representing membrane protein. Yeah, so that you can see that basically that there are four sets of six transmembrane helices, and that there are, you see there are charge bits. Actually, this is bad resolution. You know, this is where the charge is.
So main four over there really wraps around the one.
Yeah, it's really fourfold. It goes around, and it's exactly the symmetry that Greg picked up in the thing is on this. And actually, as I will tell you, I think, well, I don't know if I'll have enough time. Hodgkin and Huxley anticipated this four. It's really remarkable, actually, from the fit of their data. They didn't actually, they screwed up lots of things, which I'll also tell you, but they actually, the number, the idea that there was a four, for those of you who remember Hodgkin and Huxley, there was a four in that theory, and it was the same four.
What is the argument for the four?
I'll tell you how they got up with four. They didn't even know what the things looked like, but they got in four. These guys were good. They were good.
You said in the snippet that you put, they can't say anything about the molecular.
But they actually got the four. But by fitting, by essentially curve fitting, they got four. I mean, you really can.
That's an exponent was four, right?
Yeah, there's an exponent. No, but it was the same four.
Yeah,
it was,
sure.
It's the same four. Okay, there are lots of other. Okay. Okay, so I think, I don't know, this is, so like I said, I was worried I wasn't going to have enough to say, so I started pasting things in here. I think this, I must have stuck this on the web. This might be a good thing to read for tomorrow. I don't know, I'll figure that out this afternoon. You guys can help me if anyone would like to figure that out for our journal club. I mean, but you know, there are lots of papers like this. Complex multicellular organisms require rapid and accurate transmission of information, blah, 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 electrical signals, calcium, blah, 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 blah. Non-excitable cells, calcium transient signal events, gene expression, cell division. In epithelial cells, ion fluxes are conducted across tissue boundaries. So there are lots of physiological reasons for these things. This is really, all of these processes are mediated in part by members of voltage-gated ion channel superfamily. This protein superfamily of more than 140 members is one of the largest groups of signal transduction proteins, and many members are targets for toxins and therapeutic agents. Here we review the evolutionary relationships. And actually, there was a time that I was actually really very excited about this problem. And the reason was, I live in a world where I go to talks where there are lots of people who get up and talk about the evolution of signaling pathways. And I guess now I'm being taped. Maybe I can turn off my... No, I won't say anything. The advantage of these is that there are measurements. There are lots of measurements about how the signaling pathways work. It's not like, you know, did A stick to A? I don't know, maybe it stuck to C, but it doesn't affect the theory. You see what I mean? This is, these are actually, this is, so, and it's really, it's a, but of course, Okay. Oh, right, and I just wanted to show you this. We can talk about this tomorrow, but I just wanted to show you this so that you knew that I was not lying to you. So I just copied this early this morning from the paper that I put up. And this is sort of a tree, I don't know. But this is sort of calcium, sodium, this is potassium. KV, when they say V, subscript V, Na is sodium, Ca is calcium, K, subscript V means voltage gated. And there are many of them. So you see CaV1, CaV2, CaV3. There are NaV1 through 10. There are KVs 1 through 12. So for those of you who know Hodgkin-Huxley, or in a minute I will remind you of Hodgkin-Huxley, the things that Hodgkin-Huxley were talking about, that is their channels, were single, each NaV, each CaV, well, they didn't talk about CaV, each KV is one of theirs. So there are multiple, in us, there are many. Actually, here's KV 1 through 9. But then there are also other channels, and you can see here they have this diagram, like with the four things. This is just the way the people, so that you can see where it came from. So this is has the four domains. But then there are other channels which are have relationships. There are trip channels. There are calcium gated potassium channels. I mean, there are trees. So I don't know. Talk about that. It's a potassium channel that only works if calcium binds. And it's not voltage gated. So you can have ligand gated channels, which is that the hole only opens if somebody binds.
Where's the calcium binding?
I understand nothing about this. I can't say, but somewhere on here there's a calcium binding domain. I mean, I don't know. I mean, if you want to be imaginative, I mean, or if you want me to make something up, I'll make something up, which is that, look, I mean, you have to open the hole, right? I mean, you've got a hole, you have to open it. Well, there, you know, you just need some conformational change to drive it. So who gives a damn what's driving it? I mean, you know, that is, if you can do it with voltage, then you can also do it with calcium binding, right, or whatever, especially if it's not costing or anything, right, if you don't have to pay for it, which is what we're talking about. So, you know, essentially, I mean, this is biology, so everything that's possible occurs. And there's calcium around, so there are those.
So they also don't require ATP?
I believe they don't require ATP, is my belief. So I know very little, actually, I don't know very much about any of this, but I even know less about this. So, but I believe that it's purely passive, although I'm sure that they're also active analogs. I mean, it's really very rich. But there is this core. I mean, what's sort of interesting about it is that there's this core, which is really fairly conserved, but it's not so conserved as to be completely boring. Because, you know, I mean, there's all this different stuff that it underlies. Okay, so this is just more trees.
So what are these trees based on? Are they
sequence?
Yeah, but what part of the sequence, the whole?
We can talk about this in the journal. Yeah, we can talk about this in the journal club. I believe, so I once knew the answer to this, but I've forgotten. But I believe, we can read this tomorrow. I think that's the safest thing I can say. But if I were going to guess, I think that they actually use the whole sequence. So you could also, I mean, they're interesting businesses, because since it is known which part is, for example, responsible for inactivation or for any of the particular functions, you can make trees based on any of this stuff, right? And I think that, and I actually think that that's not how this is done. I mean, there's an interesting, I mean, one of the questions that I find interesting is how are you supposed to do this? I mean, given especially that you know so much about how these things work, at least sort of, right? I mean, maybe you don't know enough, but that is, I mean, what's the right plot to make to show the relationships, especially given this thing that, you know, that, and we can find the paper actually, like you can switch a sodium channel into a calcium channel by changing like 3 or something, amino acids, some seemingly a small number of amino acids, right, are responsible for the selectivity between the two. So, you know, it's so cataclysmic if you change one to another, if you duplicate and change one to another, then all of a sudden you're...
I think what's getting confusing here is that some of these have what I'm talking about. Well, we were just talking about one with, what, 4 subunits.
Yeah, these all have, in this one, they all have 4 subunits.
I was looking at this other paper you gave us to read. And
yeah.
I think the simplest one is just
one.
2 transmembrane domains in a pore.
Right.
So if all these are being put in the same tree, then
right.
It's a little unclear what
yeah.
The
sequences are. I agree. So, right, good. And those are down here, too. Presumably it is that. So we should resolve this tomorrow. I don't actually.
What do the colors mean on that?
I don't know. They probably. I don't know. We can resolve that tomorrow too.
I mean, is that showing that say calcium is a more fundamental channel than
sodium? I mean, what's at the root of that?
I don't know. We can. I'm now exhausted. I just put this out because I want to show you the tree.
Well, the colors are just they're associated with the label. I think this is what it's saying.
The ultimate label.
All the reds are potassium, and then blue is calcium.
Yeah.
I have two questions. Can one see in these trees whether there's selection or not, or whether these are sort of neutral resolutions? So basically, let's say you have a sodium channel, right, at the root, and then they sort of keep evolving. Can one pick out, there's some notion of efficiency or something here? I mean, there's associated function with these, right?
Right, okay, good. So,
You can't get that selection just from looking at a tree.
You need some functional.
You need a control, basically. So what people often do is look at the evolution in silent, what are called silent sites.
Okay.
Synonymous substitution.
Sure. Yeah. You compare
basic mutation rate, and then you ask whether the substitutions that cause amino acid changes are. If they're accumulating the same site rate as silent sites, then it's evolving in a neutral fashion. And there are sophisticated maximum likelihood methods for doing this. You could focus in on particular regions. But, and there's also a lot of debate about these methods too. Fair number of false positives.
And I was asking more from biophysical side, is there a notion of efficiency of these? If you go along the tree and look all the channels are getting more...
Well, so we'll talk about this, right? So we'll talk about this a little, and we can talk about that more. I don't know efficient. I mean, they do so many different things.
Right.
It is very hard to... But one thing I want to say is that you have to realize, from what I can tell anyway, and we can ask the people next week about this more, a lot of this is driven by pharmacology. Because, right, you know, when a snake bites you, right, whatever it is called, TTF, whatever the poison is, it's a sodium channel blocker. Right? I mean, most of these things, I mean, so this is, business. Okay, so, different channels are expressed in different places. So even if you look, actually, so if you look at the parts of these trees which are, like, almost identical, so these, for example, are all the moral, or in fact, even the functional equivalent of Hodgkin and Huxley sodium channel. Which I still haven't told you what it is, so this talk doesn't make any sense. So you can ask, why are there so many? Well, they're expressed in different places. So for example, you know, some of them, whatever, 1.1, 1.2, 1.3 are expressed in the central nervous system. 1.4 is predominantly expressed in skeletal muscle. 1.5 is predominantly expressed in the heart. 1.6 is predominantly expressed, actually, it turns out, in the peripheral, the central and peripheral, but it's predominantly in nodes of Ranvier. Et cetera, et cetera. So there's at least some notion. So, I mean, when you say efficiency, right, I mean they're in different cell types, so I don't know. And there's stability of this, actually. So if you, there's sort of trees, this is another tree. If you look at the rat sodium channel that is expressed in the heart, then it's more similar to the human sodium channel that's expressed in the heart than to the other sodium channels. So which sort of suggests, right, that there's tuning to environment, and I'm just showing you trees. Oh, Boris, good, just in time to finish the sentence. You can give the rest of this. Yeah, I didn't know you guys actually taped tutorials.
Yes, sir.
I didn't know you guys here at the ITP taped tutorials.
Especially
for tape. Especially, I mean, yeah. Anyway, trees. This again sort of shows the same thing, that knife fish, puffer fish, right, that is, you know, the channels that are expressed in similar places are the most similar. So there's some notion, and this sort of answers your, well, that's the only answer I know to give to your comment, but it's, you're doing different things. Okay, so that was that. So then actually the other thing that I have, and
just go back to that tree, I mean, I guess I overstated a little bit, but, you know, one interesting thing you might look at there is branch with the two, the little cluster with the two, the muscle cell.
Yeah.
It's got a very long branch, and so on. This hypothesis would be either that's strong positive selection for change in that particular clade of genes, or maybe just relaxed selection.
so it's free to just drift around in terms of its amino acid sequence.
Yeah.
A tree like that tells you something weird is going on in that branch.
Yeah, that's interesting. Okay, so how are you doing? Is this? So I think the rest of this, so Boris, the part that you missed, you missed all this. I actually forgot what we talked about that, and we talked about that. We admired Hodgkin and Huxley.
Don't do that. It's my idiotic fault. I was here.
No. I wasn't doing that for you. Sorry, Boris, that was not for you. It was because I forgot what I was supposed to say next. I'm sorry. No, I'm just trying to get back to the first slide. Okay, so, but I was trying to not make it look like I was going back to see. Okay, so now I guess the next couple of slides, I think, basically sort of just go through the basic physics of this. More of the basic physics, more than just that. So this we talked about. I don't know how useful any of this is, but I should at least remind you. I should at least remind you how Hodgkin and Huxley arrived at number four. Maybe that should be the goal of the rest of this, and then we'll stop. Because that was really a remarkable accomplishment, and there is this number four. Actually, four. This is interesting. Four comes up a lot in biology. It's sort of. Well, I mean, allosteric enzymes have four. I mean, what's up with this number four?
The law of small numbers.
Only so many. No, but that wasn't a cooperative. Anyway, I don't know. Okay, it's just fine. I'm just okay. Stupid comment. Good. Okay, so back to the slide. So okay, I want to sort of remind you. So I'm gonna sort of mumble something about how these things open and close. That's my goal to get to Hodgkin axis 4, and then I will stop. So okay, so basically the deal is that so inside the cell there is a low concentration of sodium, a high concentration of sodium. Outside, potassium is flipped. Basically, the deal is that that if you have an ion and if you have a hole in a membrane, then of course there will be a diffusive force, whatever you want to call it, which tends to push the ions from high to low. So if that happened, then the two would equilibrate, the two concentrations would equilibrate. Of course, there are pumps that are over here that are basically also paying to enforce this concentration difference, so they can't equilibrate. The concentrations are at least thought to be fixed in saying this. And in any way, because sodium has a charge, when you move sodium from one side to another, you change the potential difference of one side relative to the other. That is, you build up positive charge on this side, and therefore, if you assume that the thing was electrically neutral in the first place, you deplete positive charge on that side, and thus you have an electrical force which is pushing the thing in the other direction. And basically, the gain is, if you just want to think about the single hole, is that this will continue. That is, the sodium will continue to accumulate on this side until these two things balance. And when these two things balance, that is the electrical potential that will then flow will stop. Right, and it will equilibrate. So you could ask, right? So a reasonable question to ask is that what potential difference across the membrane would it does it require for this to equilibrate? And the way to understand that is to realize that the is basically to use Boltzmann. Mr. Boltzmann, right? That the energy, right? That your energy is e to the minus charge times your potential difference. The energy difference between being in one place and the other is e to the minus little e V over KT, and that then gives you the potential difference in equilibrium. That gives you the potential difference as a function of the ratio of concentrations inside and out. Because right, so sorry, I'm saying this badly. This is what I get. So right, C in over C out claim is e to the minus E V over KBT, where V is the potential difference across the membrane. And so you can solve for this. This is the equilibrium potential, and and you'll notice if you look at this formula that there's a scale. The scale is set by KT over E, and if you put in numbers, this turns out to be 25 millivolts. So that's what sets the scale of all excitable stuff on the cellular scale. And so that's the deal, right? That's the deal. And this is C in and C out. So those are, remember I told you the beginning God set those. Well, we don't know what set those. And that's the equilibrium potential. Now, if the potential difference across the membrane, well, for some other reason, were not equal to this number, then there will be ionic flow. Right? That is, you will either accumulate on one side or the other. So, okay, so then you ask, well, what about, I mean, I already told you about all of these ionic species, so what are the numbers, right, for those ionic species? And remember, the way the game goes, or at least the way the game is told, I don't actually know how the game goes, is that, you know, God sets the inter- and extracellular concentrations of the various ionic species. There are four ionic species that are relevant for this discussion, potassium, sodium, calcium, and chlorine. And so God set those, and then Nernst, who was the person who invented the last formula, sets what the equilibrium potential difference has to be, right, for the thing to be in equilibrium. And so if you simply look at the various numbers, these are millivolts, by the way, because 25 millivolts was the unit that we were working in, then you see that potassium and chlorine, that all of these numbers are different. Actually, that's what you're supposed to see. All the numbers are different. That is, the equilibrium potentials for the different ions were all different, but the membrane potential has to be the same. If you're just decorating membrane with them. So therefore, the thing can't be in equilibrium. There's got to be flows of various things that are going across to set. And of course, the way that the game is going to work, right, is that if you decorate your channel, your membrane with holes, right, and remember, the holes have the feature that they're specific to each ion, that each ion has its own hole that doesn't allow at least the first approximation of any of the other things through, that there's going to be some membrane potential that's going to be adopted, which is going to come from the total equilibration, right, of all of them. And it turns out that membrane potential in typical excitable cells is close, although slightly less negative than that for both chlorine and potassium. So these two are that is somewhere around minus 70 to minus 90, depending on the cell type. So one thing which is sort of curious to me, I don't know what's important again and what's not, is that everybody always, like, you know, quotes, I mean, Hodgkin, Huxley, they just said, well, this number is blah. And actually, from what I can tell, the literature for a long time just used their number. This number matter? I mean, it has to matter, right?
Sorry, which number?
These numbers. Those numbers.
So you said that they were set by God. Is the thing about evolution? Okay. So
that's why I said that. I was trying to.
So you're getting at the. So is there something to be said about comparing this, for example, intercellular concentration of everything between species, between cells?
So personally, I'm fascinated by this question. That was actually the reason I kept saying it was set by God, because so I find this to be a fascinating question, even between different cell types. Mm-hmm. Right? I mean, because, right, you know, one sort of simple way to change, I mean, you know, if you go back to our tree, I mean, one simple reason that you could imagine changing them around, right, is that if there were drift of concentrations across species, then you're going to have to compensate the channels, right? Because the channels are going to have to, to account for that, at least you could imagine that there would have to be some compensation, right? That is,
But it's presumably the channels or the pumps that set concentration in the first place.
Exactly. Well, there are pumps. So now this is why this problem is not as simple as you might first consider. Is that it's the pumps, okay? And so then maybe we should also be talking about pumps. So early on, I apologize that I don't know anything about pumps, except that, you know, at least what people say is that there's a sodium potassium pump and a calcium pump, and they don't talk about other pumps. It might be worth, if somebody's bored, to go find out what other pumps there are. I'm sure there are more pumps than just that. Those are the ones that people talk about. And there must also be evolutionary trees of pumps. But so anyway, it's complicated, right? And it really matters too, these numbers. I mean, I think they or maybe they don't, I don't know. So it's, but I once, for a reason that I'm not going to talk about here, I once really cared, actually, for a reason that I could talk about if anyone wanted to, but I won't, about what these numbers were for sodium in different tissue types. And I could not, no one could give me data. The data does not exist from the best. I sort of went to Harvard Medical School, and I went to people who should know, and they said, well, that's a good question. And I said, but it's 2000 and whatever it was. Don't we know that? But they're hard measurements. That's part of the problem. They're very hard measurements. And it's not clear why you'd want to do them, so no one does them.
Talking of some of these numbers, I mean,
I guess some years, a long time back, Larry Abbott had worked on it, where he says that the numbers which are really controlled are the number of channels.
Right.
On the memory.
Right. So it's not just Larry Abbott. So this goes back to Hodgkin, actually, right? I mean, this idea is, I mean, there's also the question of what, so we'll get to this, actually. I think we will. I'm still, yes.
We'll go back, but I'm getting
good. Yeah.
Completely lost.
Yes.
So
how far back do you want me to go? How far do you want me to go back?
Right there.
Yeah, good, yeah.
So I understand that if it's just a some kind of pour, mechanical pour, that...
Just a hole.
Just a hole, that things would diffuse and end up with the same concentrations inside and outside. Nothing else is going on, no pumps or anything.
Yeah.
Okay, and then... Click the next click. What's typically going on is there's either an excess, I guess depending on which ion it was, there's either an excess inside or outside the cell for that.
Okay, so imagine, let me try to say this again. So imagine that initially, so imagine you have sodium chloride outside, you have sodium chloride inside, they're at whatever concentration they're at, but the system is electrically neutral. There's no net charge on the outside or the inside. Okay, so now imagine you open up a hole that only allows sodium to flow. This is why it's so important that they're ion selective. Doesn't allow chlorine to flow. Just suppose you, which you can do, right? This is what Hodgkin, this is what you can do. So now, and now, you know, the higher concentration one will go. So a sodium molecule will say, oh, osmotically, it's better for me to move in. So it runs in. But now there's a charge imbalance. Because there were positive, there are equal numbers of positive and negative charges outside, and there are equal numbers of positive and negative charges inside. But if you take one of the positive charges from outside and you move it inside, now there's a charge imbalance. If there's a charge imbalance, that means there's a potential difference. And that means that the next guy who decides to go, there's of course osmotically he wants to go, but now he's moving uphill electrically because he's moving to a region where there were too many positive charges already, and positive charges don't like each other. So that then causes this other arrow. And the point is
that you've got to have all these things going on at the same time, different channels for the positive and negative.
No, you don't. I didn't, in everything I said, I didn't invoke negative channels.
Okay.
So what I said was the only thing that was important was that there are only channels that let through the positive charge. Now, if you had a channel that let through both positive and negative charge, then we couldn't have this discussion because we could, but it wouldn't be as interesting because then the negative ones would also flow, and there's the possibility of maintaining electrical neutrality while equilibrating the concentration differences, which is what would happen. Right, but because the channels are ion specific.
And are they direction specific?
They're not direction specific. There is an asymmetry, actually. That's actually an interesting question too. In fact, I must admit I don't understand. I shouldn't be so quick, actually. So I've always been puzzled by this. I'm puzzled by so many things. So, you know, if you go back to this picture, the sculpture of MacKinnon. Have you seen this before? This is cool. So it turns out MacKinnon commissioned a sculpture based on his structure. Very interesting, very nice. Anyway, so this thing, remember when I went through this, I told you it was asymmetric, right? The selectivity thing is here, right? So this is asymmetric, so it should be direction specific. So I don't know if they're just oriented, maybe they're an equal number in the membrane, they're oriented in both directions, or if these things really allow a flow in both directions. That is, you know, the way it's usually described, you don't know, you've heard these stories before. There's the way it's usually described is, oh, the ion comes in and it goes into this big hole and then it feels the helices and it's happy and then it goes through the selective bit. But if you're going the other way, which at least according to all the models, right, it's going both, doesn't care which way you go, right, then the physical environment that you would encounter is different. So it may be that it is direction specific. And in fact, there was this multivalent ion story that I mumbled about, remember? I mumbled that. So that was direction specific. So that would suggest that there were ones going, that there were just different polarities. You know, that it was inserted in both directions in the membrane and you parade for equality or something. But I don't actually know, in fact. I'm sure this is no, I just.
Okay, so just to put it in more biological context.
The patch clamps, though, are maybe, now I've confused. Did I say something?
So just to put it in sort of biological context.
Yeah.
I mean, so suppose we have a paramecium, just a single celled organ, yeah. So we're not talking about communication.
Yeah.
Why do you want to do all this stuff?
In a paramecium?
Yeah, I mean, is it,
you want, say, a lot of sodium, a lot less sodium inside the cell than outside the cell.
Well, the system uses these for signaling. I mean, right, so paramecium have certainly...
Well, let's say they're really dumb paramecia.
No, but
they're not talking to anybody else or anything.
No, but even if they're talking to themselves, so there's a classical picture, actually, which I don't... there's a Bible of ion channels, which was written by this person named Hille, who's at the University of Washington. It's this amazing... And there's this picture in the back of a paramecium bouncing off a wall.
I think I picked the wrong...
Yeah, okay.
Because I know there's all this channel work done in paramecium.
Yeah.
I don't know. Chlamydomonas probably wouldn't be
better. No, you can't. That's not much better. No, chlamydomonas is probably worse.
Okay.
So bacteria.
You say that there's very little calcium inside a typical cell, right? Isn't that what?
Yeah, that's true. In the cytoplasm. There is big calcium stores in muscle, right? There's these huge things.
There's calcium in the endoplasmic reticulum.
Yeah, that's right.
Does the organ, is that... done because the organism does. Is there a problem with having a lot of calcium inside a cell?
So this is now getting beyond me. I don't know why.
Close to sodium.
It's paying. I mean, look, the thing pays for pumping calcium out. It's not even right. It's just this thing is paying for that. And I don't know why. Does anybody know?
Well, I mean, calcium developed ion as all sorts of special properties, and then all sorts of calcium bridges. Why it has to be so? I think actually all divalents are very low. It's not just calcium.
Yeah, well, that's true, but all divalents aren't used. Well, no, but calcium is also used for signaling. I mean, magnesium is also low, for example.
Right.
I mean, but look, this is why people, I was joking.
It has to be low is another.
I was joking, but I wasn't joking when I said God set these numbers. I mean, that's the only way I know to say I have no idea what the hell is setting these numbers, or why they should be. Well, I mean, clearly the whole signaling thing wouldn't work if there weren't anti-symmetry between the sodium and potassium concentrations. That's critical. The calcium, presumably if this were high, I mean, this is used for signaling, I don't know why.
Asking a question here is that, so one can think, okay, so there are some pumps, and you know, the pump mutates, and you know, pumps twice as fast, so you know, we're going to have X larger than one times more.
No, but you're not, because there's also control of expression.
Precisely,
right, yeah.
Precisely. But there are various other mechanisms by which you can compensate a change in pump efficiency, right? Say, changing the number of pumps, right? So, ultimately, the concentration of calcium may be much more stable, right? Maybe set on the systems level through various homeostatic mechanisms, which they certainly are. So there are all sorts of molecules that buffer calcium and whatnot.
Well, in this case, I mean, it's just the low concentration of calcium, is that being maintained by an active pump?
There is an active calcium pump. It is usually
impedance. Yeah.
There's a calcium exchanger that costs.
Independent of everything you're talking about now.
Well, I mean, at the very beginning, I said there are two types of pumps that people usually talk about. There's a calcium pump, which pumps calcium from the inside to the outside, and that costs money, or ATP. And there is a sodium-potassium exchanger. And actually, maybe this is particularly relevant now. So the sodium-potassium exchanger exchanges three sodiums for every two potassiums for one ATP. So it basically, it's not exactly, that's what it does. And that actually, stoichiometry is, anyway, you can stare at the numbers. So so that's what it does.
Yeah, I'm still having a problem with the signaling thing. I mean, suppose you are a paramecium, right?
Yeah.
And you're in a pond all by yourself.
Yeah.
What are you signaling?
Yeah, so I actually think that, we can speculate about this, but to be honest with you, I think this is a perfect question to ask David Claplin, who, after all, discovered the first bacterial voltage-gated sodium channel. We can find this paper, actually, and put it up on the thing. He must have speculated, and I forgot what he said, but he will, he'll have some answer. I'm not sure that he knows, but he'll have an answer. I don't know what any of these things You know what I mean? Sponges. We were talking the other day. Sponges have action potentials. Sponges have certainly potassium channels. I don't know. It's and they have action potentials that are triggered by.
Well, but you don't have to signal to other cells.
You can send a signal around your own body.
Intracellular signal.
Well, I mean, for example, at a skeletal muscular junction, right? I mean, at a skeletal muscular junction. I mean, let's just consider. Okay, so let's talk about a single cell, right? So there's this game, right, that's played where the I'm going to screw up the game, but the nerve impulse comes down, calcium is released, releases some other chemical whose name I've forgotten, binds, and then all of a sudden the sodium channels open and they send a wave of activity out which start allowing calcium to rush in because they need to get the calcium in as quickly as possible over the whole cell so that basically the calcium can help stimulate the muscle contraction, right? And then there's this whatever it's called, the sarcomere or whatever, which dumps the calcium, like there are these additional dumps that occur, but the signaling goes over the entire cell body to tell all of the calcium channels to please open, so to let the calcium in. So there are reasons to signal quickly, actually, and in this case it has to be instant because you need all the calcium now because otherwise, you know, I can't do this, right? Because it, so I don't know if that's that's an example, right? It's not completely crazy that you would need a cell to signal, to send a signal over its entire surface to tell everybody open now, please. I mean, what's striking about it is it's very fast. I mean, and so it's millisecond time scale, so at least for our channels. And so there's a question about why, under what conditions would you need it for very fast. I don't actually know paramecium's going to do. I don't know in Clapham's sodium channel, although we could find out what the characteristic time scale is. I mean, this would be actually one thing, way to sort of, you know, what's the characteristic time scale of the response of these channels. It could be seconds for all I know, right? In which case, it's a totally different game.
Could one ask the same question in the other way by saying that, look, even with the given components, if you wanted to do the same thing, basically respond to some action potential, could you rig up the system in a different way?
Yes.
I mean, of course there's another level where you could have designed anything and everything, but even with the given ion channels or whatever, could you have just not do it with calcium or... But I don't know if that's a reasonable question. But
no, I think it's a very reasonable question, actually. I don't
know. That might point towards why calcium or something like that. I don't know. Perhaps.
Yeah, I'm not sure you're allowed to ask questions like that.
And then what's going on with all the other cations and anions that we have to worry about? Like magnesium and molybdenum.
Well, magnesium is very low concentration. Molybdenum, I'm not qualified to comment on their uses for any of these things. What is said...
But there's not channels for them, channels.
I am not aware of magnesium channels. I am not aware of molybdenum channels. Rubidium was actually often, it was used by McKinnon to great effect. Actually, rubidium is the one, if you look at the periodic table, it goes sodium, potassium, rubidium. It's not physiological, but it was used to great effect as a control to sort of study the transport of rubidium. Because, you know,
so would they just reach diffusion equilibrium? Is that what goes on?
That's a good question. But so presumably rubidium goes through, the same potassium channel, right?
It does, it just goes through a slower rate.
Smaller ion.
Yeah, no, rubidium is bigger than potassium. It does go through, but it goes through at a lower rate. Rubidium is bigger. The diameter is bigger. If the diameter is bigger, the rubidium is bigger, but it does go through, but it goes through slower. But remember, there are also, and this is, remember the thing, I would like to recall a comment, I would like to recall. I would like to recall, if we go back to the words of the great Hodgkin and Huxley, they say sodium, potassium, and a small leakage current. This leakage current consists of non-voltage-dependent channels that are not even necessarily ion-selective to this degree that also exist on the membrane. And that is, there are other ways for things to get through, and things do get through, and it could even be gated, but they're non-voltage dependent. That is, these are not the only ways of transporting sodium and potassium. It's just that for excitability, these are what are critically required. And I think the expression levels of the others are much lower, which is why leakage transfer was dismissed as being small. So there are ways of getting magnesium. I mean, you can get proteins across membranes, you can certainly get magnesium.
But returning to the question of setting those numbers, one could conceivably dream of make falsifiable hypothesis here, right? So suppose somebody is willing to measure things up in a bunch of different cell types and different animals, right? Different organisms, right? And then the question is whether, say, intracellular calcium is more conserved than any of calcium changes.
You mean the level is?
Yeah.
Yeah, that would be really interesting.
Yeah, I mean, maybe that first column could be roughly constant, but the extracellular concentration in marine versus freshwater organisms, like, it can't possibly be.
That's true.
And why is that interesting? Sorry.
Well, I guess the question here would be, what are the numbers that are set on the level of a system?
Sure.
And what are the numbers on a level of amino acid sequence, right?
Yeah, if that first column is roughly constant, cells living all over the place, then given the second one is not,
right.
And then this becomes much more confusing in terms of.
But it has to be, this also gets to how the pumps work. I mean, the pumps, right, presumably have some way of deciding when to pump. And it's presumably not, and presumably their decision is based on the ratio of concentrations. I mean, that is any decision making ability. I mean, for the same reason as this, right, what can be measured are the ratio of concentrations. And that's how you would, if you were to design a pump, make decisions.
Well, I think
and
so, practical purposes, you imagine that right. There is some sort of gigantic calcium buffer.
Yes.
Right. That proteins just bind, suck up calcium.
Right.
Right. Which they well may. Right.
Yeah.
DNA right? Sucks up positive.
Right.
So.
DNA is negative.
You can imagine sort of a giant buffer which will happily stabilize calcium at a fixed concentration.
Mm-hmm.
In sort of fairly wide range of external concentration, but ultimately the question would be, given the possible variability of proteins, is calcium concentration more conserved than the properties of...
Yeah, it's interesting. So let me actually... can I just... Because I want to stop in 5 minutes. Because then everybody has 30 minutes to relax before Mike talks. Is that good? Well, I think everybody should have a little time to relax. So what I guess... So let me just quickly say what the rest of this thing says. So the part that I haven't talked about that I don't think I'm going to is that it is true that... holes. So I mean, this little picture, right, assumes the holes are always open, but the holes aren't always open. In fact, they're opening. They open and close in a voltage-dependent fashion. So basically, the total current that's going across the membrane is due to there are sodium holes and potassium holes. Is basically there's a difference between right. If the membrane potential is V, if V is equal to VNA, there's no sodium current. If V is equal to VK, there's no potassium current. These are the Nernst equilibrium potentials for sodium and potassium. But then there's some thing here, functional form. There's dynamics to this. This is which basically tells you how these things open. And one of the differences between the various types of sodium and potassium channels, in fact, maybe the main difference, pragmatically from the point of view of at least excitable physiology, is the dynamics or the ways that these things work. And there are multiple ways in which they work. And there's these sort of pictures. There's this sort of picture. I guess I already said the picture. So maybe ignore it. But the picture is basically the cartoon is that when the membrane potential across the is very negative, That is when there's much more negative charge on the inside than on the outside, then the thing tends to be closed. When it's very positive, when you make it more positive, then the thing is open, but then there's this little ball that hangs into the cytoplasm that when it becomes very positive, it blocks it, so it's closed again. So there are sort of two moving, nominally from this, there are two moving parts. The number four comes in, the origin of the number four comes in because there are four subunits, and it is believed, since Hodgkin and Huxley, that the open-closed transition actually requires four independent things to happen. So imagine you have a protein which has four bits, and each of them, each of the bits has to undergo a conformational change in order to go from open to closed. So there are lots of closed states, because you need all of them to be in a particular, all of them to be in the same state for it to be open. You see, so now we've just invented the idea, well, rediscovered the idea that in fact, that there are going to be huge numbers of states that are associated, even at this very naive level, right? There are these four things, right? Now, what's not known, I mean, if there are these four things, if the four things open independently, right, then you need four events to occur for it to go from closed to open. There are going to be four, there are zero, open, zero, one, two, three. Those are all closed, then four is open. All four are transitioned, then it's open. But then there's also blocked and unblocked. So that means we're now up to eight, right? But now then you could question, well, maybe they don't all open together. I mean, independently, and they could open together. I mean, there is allosteric, after all. I mean, there's history of this. So, and Hodgkin Huxley's curve fits suggested that there wasn't, but I don't think it's really known. And people make measurements. Different channels have different kinetic properties. Let me see here, I did it closed to open, open to closed. You can sort of count parameters. I mean, because, if you want to talk about evolution, parameters, you can count the parameters in these simple models. But the problem is, and this is one of the difficulties, and even if you look at sodium potassium channels, I think that this is fair, we can talk about this more tomorrow. You look at these trees and you say, well, shit, what I really need is to know, the rates, what's happening to the rates. Because then we can at least talk about something about what's happening. Then the problem is that no one agrees that the models are uncertain. Even in this, that is, I was just bumbling about how it had to be, but maybe it's not that way. I mean, for example, remember when we talked about the sodium channel, we said there are these four domains, and, I admitted to you that they weren't all identical. That, one and three were more similar than two and four. So maybe actually, I don't know. So there are lots of possible models that you could make in response to that. So then, in order to validate the model, you have to fit the data. And this is a mess. So this was Hodgkin Huxley's fit. Their fit. They actually predicted the number three instead of four. In fact, they found that they could fit their opening and closing data best if they assumed that there were three things that opened for sodium and four for potassium. And that's what they found. Four turned out to be the right number for potassium, at least if you believe the party line. I don't know if you should, but the party line is that, there are these four, bits, and they open independently, then that sort of works. The three, I don't know. And then,
what's the minimal number of parameters that
you need?
So you're saying that, in many states, it's complicated.
Yeah, okay, good, here.
My next question is going to be, well, do we care how complicated it is? I know that there's all atom structure and one more.
Yeah, I have no idea. Of course, I have no idea.
But to what extent do we care?
So it depends on what question you want to ask. So if you want to ask an evolutionary question, I have no idea. I still don't understand what the question is, actually. I mean, we're still stuck, I point out to you, on what sets the concentrations and is this relevant? And, what do the model care? So one answer to this, though. Oh, no, okay.
The concentration is a more difficult question.
Okay, Boris, good. Let me give you one thing. Let me tell you one thing. There is a field. Let me give you one comment about this question. I think there's only one thing I can say with intelligible, which actually has a slide. So there is a field, there are many fields, but there's a field of sodium channel pharmacology. So I told you that there were 10 different sodium channel paths. So this is a field in which there are like hundreds of papers written. These I took from two papers. And you'll notice that I think this one is NAV 1.4 and this one is 1.7. So but 1.7, I don't remember, it's some neural sodium channel. And there are two mutations that were discovered in patients who had severe neurological disorders because of the sodium, because of this mutation. That was it. The only thing wrong with them was this mutation. And so, right? And so you, and what was done was sort of studied the kinetics and how they open and close. So, you know, you basically just do experiments. So there are these papers plotted with these curves. That mutant in them somewhere. Well, the curves look pretty much the same. Then you look like it. I don't know what this is plotting. It's plotting something. But, I mean, you can see that this is like the time scale of something. It's a function of voltage between three. So they change a little. But, you know, this person...
These are the three curves. These are the three.
This one is the three. This is, you know, this is wild type, and these are mutant one and mutant two. And this is like time scale of inactivation, time scale for the whole block, and it's a function of membrane potential.
So the time scale changes by a factor of 5 or something.
It changes, but okay. So from here it goes from 0 to 1, and here it goes from 0 to 2, and here it goes to 0 to 3. So I don't know. It changes here a factor of 2, but this is a very, unfortunately, this isn't. You see it on my screen? Oh, it's at -80. Yeah. So no, it's at -40.
But the bottom line is.
Apparently that matters. That's what I'm trying to say.
Constant changes by a factor of 3, and that matters.
It matters a hell of a lot.
Okay.
That's my point. That is, there are databases of sodium channel opathies that you basically screw up in any way and forget it. Like you get really sick, and the numbers are there, but there's no understanding of this though, of why, right?
Yeah. That's sort of many things that one may want to understand about it, right?
Yeah.
What effect this has and what causes it.
Yeah.
But another question would be. So you stared at the kinetics of these channels for a while. So how many parameters does it take to fit all this collective data?
Well, okay, but in order to answer that, then you have to say with which model?
So what is the model which fits all the data with the smallest number of parameters?
Well, I think Hutch and Huxley, I mean, Hutch and Huxley.
Will fit all the data. And Hutch and Huxley has 8 parameters or something.
Right, but it turned out to be wrong, because it assumed that the, Hodgkin actually assumed that the inactivation, that the binding of the ball to the, Hodgkin actually assumed that the inactivation, that is this, that is whether the binding rate of this to this is independent of which state the closed channel is in. And that turns out to be, I mean, that's been shown to be false. Physiologically. Now, whether that matters for fitting the... Oh, I see. This is your point.
Absolutely.
Oh, I see. So you say screw it because...
Yeah,
it's,
absolutely.
Because, you know, it doesn't matter. You only care about nerve signaling. You're only interested in that.
Yeah.
Right. But okay. But then you have to decide... And don't you also have to decide, though, which aspects... I mean, there's action manager propagation, but there are sort of sub-threshold response. I mean, now we have to get into like, you know, which prop there's spiking, right? There's spike rate as a function of input current. I mean, there's just so many things, right? Matters for what? It's neuro. Now we're into neuroscience. I don't know. I mean, I just don't know. I'm not sure what you're supposed to, right? It's
okay. I'm so perfectly happy to start with. The model that explains some significant chunk of data, and then refine it as we encounter sort of physiologically important mutants, which cannot be described by your existing model.
Right. So.
So that's sort of. One end of the problem, and another end of the problem, from purposes of evolution, I would be tempted to ask, okay, so tell me roughly, what is the mutational cross-section, if you like, of these parameters?
Yes.
How many mutations does it take to change this parameter, or maybe these parameters don't change independently, as far as mutations are concerned?
Yeah.
Maybe they're coupled. So what are the properties of, so again, the experiment here would be, so put your artificial, put your channel into artificial membrane and measure all the kinetics you care to fit.
Yeah.
Do sloppy PCR on it, just mutate the hell out of it. And
so some of this has been, so McKinnon actually, before he became a crystallographer, did some of this, some very nice work on showing that mutations were coupled, a couple of different parameters for some aspects of potassium channel. And it's clear that this has not been worked. I mean, this is not, most of this is not known, but you could do this. I know, I think it would be interesting. I agree with you.
This is like making a genotype phenotype map of this whole thing, basically.
Yeah.
Saying that this blasted with the.
Yeah, no, I think it would be interesting.
See what comes out, and then, of course, you can.
Okay, so I would like to propose that that we pause, and that tomorrow we'll. Well, so in 20 minutes, Mike will talk about the evolution of genomes, and then and tomorrow we'll have a journal club, which hopefully someone will help run.
Wait, so what are we reading?
It's on the wiki. Everything's on the wiki. We're fine. We're following your program here. You know, get with the program. You know, it's on the wiki. You go and you see there's a paper. I don't know if it's the right paper though. Maybe we'll have to change it. But it's some paper. I don't remember. I uploaded something arbitrary, which was on the evolution of.
Well, you also have a paper in there for today.
Yeah, I did. I uploaded that too. Yeah. We could read that tomorrow if you like that better.
I haven't read the second one.
Is that one
the first one was somewhat useful.
Is that good? Okay, I'll just put some.
I'm still having a hard time with the whole context of why anybody's doing all this stuff. But
wait, why channels are important?
Yeah, I mean, I know they're used in.
Signaling.
Yeah.
But why?
Yeah. I mean, I'll have to do some reading in the cell or something, I guess.
Yeah, sorry, I didn't get to that part. What was an English
paper that people just take a look at in addition to another paper, but it had a fair amount on the presumed phylogeny of these different types.
Good. Okay. So anyway, we can continue this tomorrow. And but for now.
Record that.